try to build a more entrepreneurial and self-reliant local food system. Industrial standards in agriculture virtually institutionalize and enforce the indifference of the general population to the welfare of the land and the people of the land. Under industrialism, the farmers, and especially the smaller farmers, are overworked and underpaid, and this exactly corresponds to the condition of the land under industrialism. Much is taken, little is given back. The fertility that is given back most often comes from non-renewable sources. The organic waste that should be returned to the fields as fertilizer most often enter streams and rivers as pollutants, as do the excess chemical fertilizers. The work of the industrial economy, we may say, is to transform assets into liabilities. Wendell doesn't mince words. And more to the point, to be interested in food, but not in food production, is clearly absurd. Okay, so ideally I would just stop at that point, but I'm actually, I got about 7 minutes more, so so I'm going to give Alan a little sickness here. So that's my organization, Appalachian Sustainable Development. Won't say much about it, except to say we're a community-based nonprofit working, if you know where Knoxville, Tennessee is, we're a little bit northeast of Knoxville, a little bit southwest of Roanoke, Virginia, about a 12-county area in the Appalachians. And we often use this, another Wendell quote, to kind of guide our work. And here Wendell says, before we do any development, I consider my organization, first and foremost, to be an economic development organization. And he's talking here about economic development, housing, retail development. We should ask ourselves these three questions. What's already here? Just imagine if the settlers of this country had asked that question. What does nature allow us to do here? What would you say, what are the limits of this place? And what does nature help us to do here? What are the assets that we uniquely have? Because every community, every region, every bioregion has particular assets and particular constraints. So in our area, real quickly, it's a little different from you all. A lot in common, a little different. We're more mountains. And so, first and foremost, we've got mountains. I'm trying to bring the lights down. Yeah, that would help. You can see them well. That's better, thank you. So we've got mountains. Okay. We've got a lot of this pasture land. It suffered quite a bit in the drought last year, probably will again this year, but again, historically, some of the richest, most productive grasslands. And then we've got little bits of flat land. We don't have a lot more flat land around here, and historically, that flat land has been in tobacco. And then we have fellows like this, Martin Miles, fourth or fifth generation local farmer, tobacco farmer. This is the core of the farmers with whom we work, folks like Martin. We've also got the reality of our assets being what we've come to say being overused and undervalued, as when our timber is extracted at high rates, whether through clear cutting or high grade, and then leaves the area with virtually no economic value added beside the price of the log. I love this graph. This comes from a fellow named Stuart Smith, who's a retired USDA economist. I met him at a Southern SOG meeting a few years back. If you kind of study that, it's in a way, it sort of, to me, in one graphic depicts the predicament for agriculture in particular and natural resource-based economies in general. It's basically a century worth of data there, from the beginning of the 1900s to the end. The bottom section of the graph kind of looks beige, is the, let me just say that the entire thing is what we pay as Americans for our food. It's the cost of our food dollars. And the bottom there is the input costs. And you can see they've gone through various spikes, but basically they've increased about fivefold during that time. The middle is the farm gate price. That's what's actually coming to farms. And then I'm sure you can guess what the top is that's grown so much. The marketing, the distribution, the transportation, the packaging, the labeling. And so that says a number of things in that graph. One is that, as other people have noted, the vast majority of our food dollars are paid not for the food itself, and certainly not to the farmers, but to the other attributes that we've come to expect, the convenience, the packaging, the labeling, the branding, et cetera, and certainly the delivery. The other very interesting thing, this is not adjusted for inflation. These are actual dollars, real dollars. It's interesting to note that at the beginning of the century, farmers got about $40 billion, and nearly 100 years later, farmers got about $40 billion. And of course, there's many, many fewer farmers divvying that up, and gives you a pretty good sense of why so many people have left farming there. In a nutshell, our work is about increasing that red area, getting the farmers more, probably, I would say, decreasing some of the top, but also capturing more of that close. And people still want food convenient. They want it delivered in ways they can count on it. So maybe we can make some of those systems a little closer to home. I won't read this, but although there's still some folks who dispute this, I think it's generally fairly widely recognized that we're probably dealing with fundamental shifts in the climate and that human activities have a lot to do with it. And much of that, it's a lot of different reasons for that, but much of it comes from the fact that we move things around a lot. Tenfold increase in shipping between 1950 and 2000. Another interesting statistic that isn't up here that corresponds with that. Stacy Mitchell wrote a book called Big Box Swindle, and in that book she says that in 1960 we had about 4 square feet of retail space per person in this country, in 2000 we had 38. Are we 9 times better off by virtue of having all that shopping? I don't know. Same way with shipping. And of course, many of you are familiar with the statistics that come out of the Leopold Center about the carbon sequestration, or rather the carbon emission component of our food system, the greater amount of fossil fuel energy to produce calories. And also the hidden consequences of this type of a food production system. I don't have the time to go into this, but this gentleman, Lucas Benitez, is an amazing man who's with the Immokalee Coalition of Farm Workers. But basically, the fact that so much of our food that arrives on our plates cheap, it arrives there cheap not only because of externalized environmental costs, but what happens with workers. There's an alternative that's emerging. This is what I'll be focusing on. It's farmers markets. Go ahead. Farmers markets that have grown from about 1,500 back in the early 90s to over 4,400 now. And we work quite a bit beyond farmers markets with actual retailers, and I will talk about that in more detail. This is one of our local retailers, Food City, that has 90 stores. Real quickly, we work on forest-related issues, same sort of idea of adding value to your resources. So we saw the logs that come out of our forest in an environmental fashion. We kiln dry them in kilns like this. Go ahead. And then we make them into hardwood flooring, as you alluded to earlier. And then I'll just close with this slide here. Some of you are familiar with James Kunstler. He's written a number of books. The last one was The Long Emergency, basically about peak oil issues. And I love this quote because he says, this is what's happening in the coming decades, that life will become increasingly and intensely global and smaller in scale, and that the only intelligent course of action is to prepare for it. I think in a lot of ways that's what many of you are trying to do here today, is prepare for what will be a very different world in 15, 20 years. Thank you.
And what we're going to do is, after each speaker, we're going to allow you to answer questions. We're going to take 5 minutes for questions and answers from each speaker after each presentation. And I am going to come down to you with a cordless mic. So when you see my hips coming, you just count them.
Essentially, it's the idea of adding value to our resources. We have some of the best quality hardwood in the world in the central Appalachian areas of Kentucky, Virginia, and Tennessee. And historically, it's been cut at high rates and sent out for processing. So we've built basically a small wood processing center. We have a sawmill, 2 dry kilns, and we're about to build our own millworks company. We've been contracting that out. But basically, we take a very rigorous set of environmental standards under a professional forester. We manage private forest land. We process it through and we sell finished product under a green brand called Sustainable Woods. We sell directly to contractors and architects and others and individuals.
Okay, next question. We'll raise your hand and I'll come to you.
I realize you may have already touched on this stuff, but I was just wondering if you could shed some light on what might be the biggest barrier to sustainable food systems in the United States.
What was the question?
What's the biggest barrier to sustainable food systems in the United States? There's a lot of things, but I'm a pragmatist at heart. I don't get to sort of talk about the big picture stuff quite as often. I think it's a lot of things. It's our focus on cheap food. It's our focus on convenience. It's many cultural issues. But I think at a fundamental level, the reality is most people want an alternative to be relatively easy. And the truth has been that up until very, very recently, getting something else, let's say local organic as an example of that, has just been tough. It's been difficult. If you live close to San Francisco or New York, you couldn't get it in Appalachia, that's for sure. And so at one level, one of the biggest obstacles is simply the lack of infrastructure in communities, whether it's flooring made from the trees that are right over the ridge, or whether it's food coming from the local community produced in a good way. So I think while there's many policy barriers, there's many cultural barriers, one of the big things is that most of our communities simply are not able at this point to produce food on a significant scale to get to ordinary folks at a relatively affordable, not just the cheap, relatively affordable way. We need community infrastructure to do this, and that's what we do on a small scale.
Anybody on this side? Okay, we'll go right here.
Hi, Colin had a question there. Just a comment, first of all, Hatch said this coming from Ames, Iowa. With the slide.
It's Iowa State.
That's Iowa State.
I know. Yeah. Sorry, I forgot to change that.
I wonder if you just talk a little bit about the particular difficulties of transitioning former tobacco farmers into other forms of agriculture.
Yeah, it's been a challenge, and we're only recently, we've been at this about 7 years now, we're only recently having some success. The snowball's rolling down the hill, and it's beginning to build some size to it. Two things. One is that, first of all, and I was saying a little bit about this with some folks over dinner last night, the organic food or sustainable food movement's preoccupation with kind of cool specialty stuff has been part of the problem. And the reality is that I crudely say that we started with an organic growers co-op that was basically a few Amish families and a couple of back to the landers. And I say that the shift we made back in 2000 was from the ponytail crowd to the Ollie North crowd. And that's pretty descriptive of what it was. And what that means, and for those of you, young, you can look Ollie up in the history books. But the truth of it is that some of it's what they were being asked to grow. I could not have gone to these first few early adopters among these tobacco farmers and got them to grow, Thai basil or radicchio. It just wasn't going to happen. So part of it was the choice of crop, things that wasn't that different for them. Similarly, in our community, which is, not all low income, but the Appalachian community are not full of foodies, we have to be able to produce things that ordinary people would want. So part of it was finding something other than that exotic niche orientation, which has sort of held sustainable organic agriculture in a certain box for a long time.
Kathy, our last question over here. Do you have any youth involved
in your program? We do, although not as much as I'd like, and that's I was asking for some help from some of the folks here who are more involved, because that's a new emphasis for us, to be perfectly honest. We haven't done much. We do stuff with high schools. We have a learning landscapes program. We build gardens and nature trails and whatnot, working gardens on school property, but that's been new to us, and we need more. One nice thing, though, is that when you're into sustainable farming, it does attract younger people. So the average age of the farmers in our groups is more like 40 instead of 58. But yes, we need more young people. It's kind of a weakness of our work so far.
I'm giving
my
hand.
Okay, next up we have Preston Marin. And this is Dr. Preston Marin. And Dr. Marin is the Associate Physician in Chief at Kaiser Permanente in Oakland. And he has done a remarkable thing by organizing a farmer's market for the benefit of the staff, the farmers, the visitors, and all the communities surrounding, and also working with networks of Kaiser. Now, I met him last night, so you have to go to his blog, really, and look for how to make pizza crust. And all sorts of good things out of good food.
Thank you very
much. Dr. Mayor.
It's my first time in Nashville. A couple of impressions. I don't know that I've ever been to a community where I heard a young gardener talk and say, you know, we try to give away everything we grow first, and then we sell what's left over. Any place I've been around the country, it usually is the other way around. It says a lot about the spirit that I've felt from people here. Also, to go from an organization that started just a year ago to 100 different partners in an event like this today also tells me a lot. It gives me a lot of hope for the future for this community in this area. It's a wonderful process, and I've had the opportunity to meet some great leaders of Food Security Partners. And in particular, I want to single out Cassie Johnson. Not only did she put this together for all of you, but she also just did a great job in organizing and taking care of me to get me here at the right place at the right time. She's done a great job, and I just want to give her a special thanks. So as Joyce mentioned, I'm a physician. I've been a primary care women's health care physician with the Kaiser Permanente program for over 36 years now. Kaiser Permanente is the largest not-for-profit prepaid medical care program in the country. It's located in 8 different states in the District of Columbia. It started at the Oakland Medical Center about 65 years ago, where I've been for my whole career. Kaiser Permanente is an organization, because of its prepaid nature, the way medicine is practiced, the focus is on preventive health, not just on sick care health. And focusing on prevention, focusing on the total health of not only the members of Kaiser Permanente, but the staff and the surrounding communities, is good for everybody. And when you focus on total health, obviously, we're going to focus on food as one of those components. When you think of the basics about healthcare for any population of people, do people exercise, are they smoking or not, is it alcohol or drug abuse, safe sex? And when it's all said and done, what people eat every day probably has more to do with their health than almost anything else that can come up. I've certainly seen that as a physician. And for many, many years, we've tried all kinds of education programs to try to help people eat better. Next slide, please. And nothing really ever seemed to make a difference. So about 5 years ago, I thought, well, what would happen if we brought something to our hospital that really models good health, that was good for everybody? It worked well for the staff people who were there. It worked well. Could it work for patients who came? Could it work for visitors to the hospital? Could it work for the surrounding community? Could it also be good for the farmers? I found a Farmers Market Association leader who was willing to give it a try. And on May 16, 2003, we had 7 vendors out in front of our hospital. It was an all-organic market. The strawberry vendor did $2,000 worth of business. And at a normal farmer's market, she usually did $800 worth of business. Wow. So that market became a sought-after market for local farmers. Next slide, please. We have all different kinds of shoppers. And here you can see a little child who's getting a taste of a fresh peach. This peach was grown by Marlene Gonzalez of the Lone Oak Ranch. She's been at our market every Friday now for 5 years. And in the background, we kind of see all the people coming to our market right outside of our medical center. Next slide, please. Well, just taking one baby step, starting a market at a hospital, putting good food in front of people that they found hard to pass up. People then begin to shop at a market that maybe never shopped at a farmer's market before. They're coming in for health care. They're coming in for appointments. They're coming in for an x-ray. But when they walk by a fresh peach, or walk by a bundle of fresh asparagus, or walk by a big basket full of arugula, people would stop and go, hey, what's that? What do I do with it? And those of us out there would talk about a simple Meyer lemon vinaigrette. It takes you about a minute to prepare, and you've got yourself a side dish for a great dinner. So from the one market, we now have 30 markets, the Kaiser Permanente facilities in 6 states and in D.C.
Oh, wow.
Next slide, please. to keep the focus on fresh food and to just get the conversation going, I had a basic theory that if I can cook something, anybody can cook. I'm just your basic aging gynecologist. I'm not a trained chef, but I do like to cook. My wife, my son, and I, we hang out in the kitchen. When we have a good day, we shop at the market and we cook together. So I like that. So what I would do is take whatever was fresh at the market, write up a recipe, send it out. First it started going to just 3,000 people at my hospital, and then over the last 6 months it turned into a blog, and now we get about 15,000 readers a month. And there are 400 or 500 recipes on this site that are searchable. Next slide. As you can see, I get feedback from people about the farmers markets, and when they send out the recipes, next slide. So then there's the logical extension. If you start farmers markets outside the hospital, what about the food that people are going to eat after they've had their hip replaced? Well, you know, like many hospitals, our food came in from many, many miles away, often from 100 tons of it came in from other countries out of the 250 tons of fruits and veggies we use at our 19 hospitals. And we said, well, could we do this a little bit differently? Next slide. So as you can see, kind of the different states, 150 tons of our food came from California, but a lot of it was coming in from elsewhere. So we said, could we make a difference? Could we reduce the food miles? Could we support our local growers? And indeed we did. Last year, we just started this program in 2006. In the last year, we had 75 different small and mid-sized sustainable ag local farmers whose food got into our 19 hospitals, 6,000 meals a day, and the cherry tomatoes on our salad. Next slide, please. It's our kind of a vision statement, which mirrors, I think, the vision of your organization, too. And next slide. And the cherry tomatoes, Mr. Chao Vang, who's a mom farmer who leases 9 acres, we made the connection between his farm and our hospital. And he said, thanks to Kaiser Permanente, he had a guaranteed market, he got a fair price, and he said, thanks to that kind of partnership, he's able to still be farming this year for his family. We hope to expand that kind of reach by matching local supply with local demand. And as Anthony was saying, one of the biggest barriers, which is a very good question raised here, in my mind, is distribution system. Because there just wasn't a way before for Mr. Vang's tomatoes to get into our hospital. We took some existing distribution systems, also created a new one to try to make the link between the small farmers and the big institutions. And so that's the basic message. Nothing we've done can't be done anyplace. It's all very, very generic. And I know that out of this meeting, will come many linkages between those that grow good food on good land and those of you that want good food to eat. Next slide.
Thank you.
And if you're interested in looking up lentil soup with chard and turkey meatballs or a real simple pizza crust, and you can put anything on if you want to. Lucius might have a different idea of what you want to put on the cuisine, Mr. Carroll, but I three different kinds of mushrooms and some herbs and some cheese to make yourself a really good pizza. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, ready for some questions from Dr. Mary.
I want to make sure I got this right, because the idea of what you're saying you did just sounds amazing. So a hospital that in the past paid, probably went through some other kind of middle person who did bought the food for you, now you might have somebody who's doing the purchasing yourself, and so you're spending a little more money on that, but you're paying us for the food because you're buying it right from the farmer?
Well, let me We have 19 hospitals, 6,000 meals a day, 90% of the food still comes in through Cisco because it's got to be a certain portion for this and that because of all the hospital type regulations. 10% of the food are fruits and vegetables. That's 250 tons of food. A lot of that would come from elsewhere, from large 100,000-acre growers. And it would come in through a central commissary. What we did is we partnered with a local nonprofit, Community Alliance for Family Farmers, that basically said, we will focus on a new and beginning future farmer for America and try to bring them into the food chain. We will get their food to your central commissary. Let's partner together and figure it out. And we started with 22 farmers, now we're up to 75.
And it really increased your cost?
Well, there was a slight increase in cost, but mind you, it's also less expensive to buy food in season, even at a fair price, than it is. We were buying red seedless grapes, shipping them in from halfway around the world, totally out of seasons because nobody thought about it. Well, for the last 3 years, we thought about it. We're offering things that are now seasonal much more regularly. And once again, this is only a small part of the whole system. We don't have all our organic menu. But when we move into beef, rice, grains, milk, chicken, cage-free eggs, et cetera, et cetera, yes. But one step at a time.
Okay, one more question.
She kind of just said my question a little bit, but I was going to ask, most insurance companies and things like this are really concerned about the economic bottom line. So, could you talk about the specifics of how this is economically feasible?
Well, it works this way. Once again, we're a prepaid medical care program. So, it's better for patients and for the program for people to stay healthy rather than for them to get sick. And food's important. And that's a good message for us in Kaiser Permanente's marketing campaign. If you were ever in a region where Kaiser Permanente existed, you would see a marketing campaign called the Thrive Campaign, which has been one of the most successful ad campaigns we've ever had nationally. And the Thrive Campaign started because of the farmer's market. The ad agency came to my hospital, talked to the employees to say, what it's like to work at Kaiser? They said, hey, we have a farmer's market. We are about broccoli and blueberries. So the marketing value alone far outweighs any cost for sustainably grown food and a little added cost in the food system. And that's well recognized by leadership. So it's a matter of having people see that it's a benefit for everybody, it's a benefit for the program, and we will spend more money on the food because we believe it's good for everybody.
Okay, thank you so very much. In case you all are wondering how we're doing this, we have a timekeeper right now. She's flashing numbers at us to keep us on track so we can get to the sessions and so we can come back together at the end and really do some more work. So we're trying to stay on time. Next up is LaDonna Redmond from Chicago. And what she's done is just an awesome thing because she decided that she, working in the grassroots in her own community, would found the Institute for Community Resource Development, and she's president of that. And she's focusing on the development of local sustainable food systems in her area in Chicago. Can you imagine that? LaDonna.
Well, good afternoon. I've been here 2 days, so it's been a really great opportunity to get to meet many of you. And I'm going to show you a video which could probably give you a lot more imagery about my community and some of the work that we've done, and then I'll wrap that up with a couple of comments. You don't have the video, the audio?
Okay.
Well, I guess I'll talk while they do that. I get my background is in community organizing. I have been involved in community organizing from, you know, at some point or another since the time I was 9 years old. I worked at Operation Push as a kid, just, you know, working on various campaigns, answering phones and letters. And the first time that I really got introduced to the idea that change could happen at a community level was during the election of Harold Washington, who was the first African-American mayor in the city of Chicago.
Yes.
And as a kid, it was really fascinating to me to watch how the adults really kind of rallied around and did various things to make sure that Harold Washington got elected. But there was lots of conversation, lots of door knocking, lots and lots of people, lots of activity, and that has always inspired me to work in community. So I've done that in a number of capacities over the past, I will tell you how long. But let's just say I've worked with a lot of different populations of people, ex-offenders, women who are recovering from substance abuse, people who are developmentally delayed, and in working with this, in this particular issue, food and food access, I have found that one thing is definitely true, that there aren't any people on the other side of the table saying that those folks right there don't deserve access to healthy food, or those folks don't deserve food, or those folks shouldn't get organic food. I have not met that person yet to say that. I've met people who have said that women who have lost custody of their children because they went to prison shouldn't get their kids back. They don't deserve a second chance. If you're a man who's gone to prison and you're trying to get a job, you don't get one. You messed it up. That's too bad. But with the issue of food, it's a unique opportunity to bring together community to really plan for the future. I know there was a word that was used earlier in a question around what are some of the biggest barriers. I really don't see barriers. I see opportunities. I think we have to look at our communities as assets, otherwise we lose the opportunity to really move forward. And I think you all have a very unique opportunity to come together. And I'm really happy to see that this is not a room full of white people. Because for me, that's the first sign that the train is not on the track. We have to have everybody at the table. We have to have everyone. We have to have everyone in the room having a dialogue. And actually, we need those communities that are most impacted by the lack of access in the lead, really talking to us and with us about how to use the resources that we bring to their communities. Are we ready yet?
I don't know if we're going to get more sound.
We just didn't have it set up in advance to project sound out of this laptop, so
okay.
We're trying to do it with the mic. But I don't
can we see video?
Okay, it's not
so
good.
I don't know. We could play the video if you want to reiterate, but it might be a little
bit. Well, we'll just go ahead and play the video.
Yeah.
It's not that long.
Can you hold the microphone up here?
It's really, really cool music, but you know, the real jazzy soundtrack that just does. That's my son and his friend, and of course that's me. And we're talking, and we're at my market. It's called Organicos. We did an organic food market at Garfield Park, not too far from my house.
Oh.
I started working in this particular area, not because I'm an expert in food or I even cared about the earth, and I have to be really frank with you and tell you that I didn't really care. I didn't know any.
Oh. Yay.
There we go. Okay, I'm quiet.
But it's a neighborhood filled with people who work for a living, all of their homes, 5 cars.
I don't know how much of that you got to hear, but really for me it was about my son. And when we talk about the personal being political, for me that's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
My engagement with the issue around food was about the life of my son, and there wasn't a room or a table that you could keep me from if I needed access to it. So I hope y'all watch out for some of the mamas out there with their babies. They get ready to kick the door in, it's over. And I mean that in the nicest of ways, but I think what's really important is that every community has the intellect to heal themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I use that quote from Yance Jensen, who was the architect of the Chicago Park District system. And he was, you know, such a wonderful landscape architect, and he was moving from Chicago after he completed his work, moving to, I believe it was Kentucky. And people were complimenting him, saying, God, you're just such an amazing architect. You really understand nature and how to pull things together. And people are going to just have such a wonderful asset in you when you come down and you show them, you know, how to do their community and make it beautiful. And he said that he had no plans on doing that. He said he didn't know what those people needed when he got there. They knew more about their natural environment than he ever would, because they were already there in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if there was anything he could do to help them, he would be more than happy to extend himself, because he believed that every community has the intellect to heal themselves. And so that's really what I bring you today, is that you all really have here in your rooms, in your communities, no matter where they are, the intellect, the capacity to heal yourself. I can't tell you what to do at all. In fact, that's probably not, people will tell you that, I wouldn't tell you what to do anyway. I can only show you what I've done, and hopefully that will encourage you to move forward in your plans to do whatever it is you decide to do in the system, in terms of changing the world or changing the food system or changing community. But just remember that there really isn't anybody outside of you all that can come and tell you how to do it. You really do have to do it yourself.
Thank you so much. So, Donna, do you want to stand and I go down?
Sure.
Okay, so we have questions for Donna. Okay. And then we'll go to the next one.
I work in the Indian community, and we're trying to do some of the same things you spoke about, and one of the problems we have is marketing the produce that we grow. How do we go about basically being successful in doing that? Because like we spoke of, we do give a lot of our vegetables away, but just last year we attempted to set up a vegetable stand, and went real. We give a lot of it away, but we want to be able to continue giving things away, but we want to grow as a market.
In our community, we did a couple of things. One is, I'm a, like I said, community organizer, and I believe in door knocking, because it's what I was raised on pretty much. And so we would go door to door, and I have had young people that I hire to pretty much go out and pass out flyers a couple a day before the farmer's market and really kind of go out and talk it up. And we would do it, we have a strategy of using a 4x4 block radius, because we're thinking people are going to walk, or those people that are around. To get a larger audience, we really just tapped into a lot of different networks. We had African American farmers come into the farmer's market. Some people were very, very interested in seeing black farmers So we have folk coming to see black farmers. We used our local newspapers. I wrote a column about food. We just did everything that we could to make people aware. The second part of that is that as an African-American person, one of the things that I had come to understand is that we have a tremendous amount of knowledge about food, particularly our food style and our food and our cuisine. And we have been told so often that our food is not good, you know, for us. And so in our discussions and conversations, we really try to get away from, help people unlearn some of that and see that this is really good stuff. There's nothing wrong with this. You know, there's nothing wrong with the way you cook your greens. You don't have to, you know, drop cooking cabbage because you're supposed to cook bok choy because you saw that on the commercial with the really cute fufu shishi farmers talking about it. You know, you got to eat what you got to eat. You know, you eat okra, eat okra. We grow okra. We got red tomatoes. We don't have purple tomatoes. You know what I'm saying? So it really is, it really was an opportunity to kind of engage with people. So you have to, I think, also be real patient with folk, too. Because, you know, we look at people and be looking at them like, mm-hmm.
Okay, we have a question right here.
I'm Brandon Greens from Bethlehem Center of National Esteem, and I serve at the Family Resource Center Youth Director at the Bethlehem Centers. But we are in a community kind of much like the one that you are representing in your video. What strategies did you use to engage other parents like yourself to help make your own garden become a reality? And the second part would be is, by doing that, did y'all see a reduction kind of like in crime with some of the other projects that y'all done by getting the people involved in helping make a change?
I'm going to answer the second question first, because the second question is probably the easiest one to answer, and it's that, you know, no, we did not see a reduction in crime. We didn't measure that. I can tell you, though, that we drew a lot of attention from people who would be what we would call pharmaceutical salespeople. And we got their attention because we hired their uncle and their cousin to come work with us on the urban farm site. We purposefully did not go after youth involvement. I went after men who were 35, 40 years old, sort of out of the job market, but had some skill sets that they had acquired, but had, for whatever reason, not been using them. So I got Pookie and them off the porch, and they over in the farm site, and they over there sweating and working, and they getting paid. So my pharmaceutical people were like, well, how can I get in? Because they're making more money than I'm making. I'm over here risking a lot. So we got some of those guys over into, you know, our farm sites and at our farmer's market. So if there was a reduction, it may have been just people shifting jobs, you know what I'm saying? I don't want to give you any kind of statistic that, yes, we solved crime on the west side. We did not. We also, now this is another part of it, is that because we have some farm sites and they have raised beds outside, some of the pharmaceutical people like to place some of their product over in our stuff. And I try to explain to them that there's a lot of people that drive past these gardens because I get a lot of public support. I don't know who looks at those gardens. They don't always call me. So I'm like, you put your stuff over there, you know, you might be in a little bit of trouble if you keep going back and forth. And they were like, yeah, okay, whatever. Well, a couple days later, they were all in jail. So it works. It serves a purpose. Your first question was what?
What strategies did you use to engage other parents like yourselves to help make that garden really flourish and become reality?
We got other people involved basically around the issue of attraction, you know, rather than going out telling them that they should be involved. And I'm going to talk a lot more about that in the workshop, but I purposefully did not go out and say, this is what you should be doing, you need to come over here with me. I let people see what we were doing and then come over if they chose to. But I think that was pretty much an even playing ground because it was like, you know, this is going down, you know, with or without you, because I believe that my child deserves access to fair and healthy food. You don't, that's cool. You know what I'm saying? But it's here. And so people were like, first, you're trying to bring slavery back, and I'm not feeling it. You out there playing in the hot sun with holes and stuff like that? I don't like that. That's not going to work. And then it went to, well, you was on TV, and they said you got a big grant. How you do that? How you write that? Then it was, well, maybe I could come spend a little bit of time with you and find out what's really going on. And so it was always the open invitation. You know, it was never a closed door, always an open invitation. So that's how we get some most parents involved.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's give our panel.